Congress.
Well, I suppose that gets reinforced on the Hill. You know, last year, Secretary Clinton and Secretary Gates went up and said, you really need to look at the State Department and the defense budgets as part of a national security budget. And Congress instantly separates it into its different committees for appropriations, added $3 billion to defense for jet engines Gates didn't want, and took $5 billion out of the state budget. That's a pretty clear message.
What will it take, do you think, to reverse that? Secretary Gates has been very eloquent, I think, in talking about soft power and in fact, maybe coining that phrase. I don't know if he deserves credit for it. He seems to get it.
Joseph Nye coined it, but I don't know the answer because Petraeus has talked about it. Admiral Mullen has talked about it. Secretary Gates has been talking about it. We talk about it, too. It's a hard sell. Part of it, I think, is there's a misconception in Americans about how much money goes into foreign aid already. You know, many Americans, repeated public opinion surveys show people think it's 15-20% of the budget or something like that. It's less than 1%. The total foreign service is just over 7,000 now, that with the additions. We did a study a couple of years ago, 2008 base. A broken diplomacy. 30% of jobs that needed language speakers didn't have officers with the required language qualifications because we couldn't take them offline to train them. There's no training float. And dealing with congressional staffs, I often found they understand completely that the military needs a what they call it float, a reserve of people so they can keep training going. That's why every major goes to the Command and General Staff College. That's why David Petraeus has a PhD. State Department basically doesn't have that. We just did a report on training, making some major recommendations. Bottom line, you need more people if you're going to train them adequately, if you're going to have the Farsi-speaking language officers or Persian speakers and Pashto speakers in Afghanistan, if you're going to deal the Arab world. But how you get that message across right now, I truly don't know. I mean, I just went up and testified on our new report, and only one Republican senator showed up, came for 8 minutes to read a pre-prepared speech saying you can't have any more people and left without discussion. If you won't talk about it, it's kind of hard to discuss the issue.
What is the overall state of the Foreign Service today? Where do we stand? We talked about, you've mentioned some of the challenges. Is there a silver lining to the situation?
It is a little better than it was a couple of years ago. The very last budget of the Bush administration and the first two budgets of the Obama administration have gone part way to repairing the what we defined as a hollow or broken service. Obviously, that rate of growth can't continue with the current budget crisis. Everybody understands that. Silver lining, they're about halfway to where they need to be in terms of state and aid. Bad news, people who want to roll government back, if they include the Foreign Service and aid and want to roll it back to 2008 levels, they will roll it back to a level that it was truly broken.
Mm-hmm. When you think about the things that have to happen, let's move beyond some of the budget challenges and restoration challenges that you've talked about. And let's say you, in an ideal world, you were given the go-ahead to bring in whoever you needed to do and so on. How do you go about identifying the kinds of people that should be in the Foreign Service and getting them to understand that this is a great career path for them to be involved in?
Oh, there's no real shortage getting people to apply. It's a very competitive process, but it's running 16,000 or more applications a year for 400-500 people coming in. So there's plenty of people coming in, and in fact, a lot of those coming in are volunteering to go to Afghanistan, to Pakistan. I mean, and you're getting people who are in their second careers. And generally, recruiting, the age of people coming in is late 20s to early 30s as the average. I don't know what the average is exactly, but it's around there these days.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting a pretty mature group of people. You need to bring them in just like you don't bring in Army officers at mid-grades and send them out to command. You need to bring them in at the bottom because you need skills that other people have, and you need skills that are particularly diplomatic, and you need to train them up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you get back to personnel numbers. I do think we need to do some things that are different about training, and particularly because right now two-thirds of Foreign Service officers have less than 10 years in the service. That's quite a statistic when you think about that in terms of mid-level gap. But there are a variety of ways to do that, including using recently retired officers as mentors and trainers and things like that. So I think we've got a pretty good handle on how to deal with it if we can get the resources to deal with it.
Ambassador Newman, there's a lot more here, and we're out of time, unfortunately, but I'd love to have you come back and continue this conversation because it is an area that whenever someone responds the way that you did, it always leads me to believe that there's more there, and I'd love to explore it with you.
Oh, there's a lot more, and perhaps we could talk about some of the criticisms of aid, which are real, and some of the misunderstanding or the lack of understanding of the underlying problems without which one won't fix the problems we talk about.
That would be a great conversation. I'll look forward to doing it. Thank you very much, Ambassador, for being on today.
Thank you for having me.
Ambassador Ronald Newman was ambassador to Algeria, Bahrain, and Afghanistan, and he is now the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy, my guest.